I'm going to bring the House Committee on Energy and Environment to order.
And the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources is now in session.
Well, good morning, everybody. At this early hour for the beginning of legislative days, we have this morning a combined committee hearing of the Senate and the House for two items on our agenda. The first will be a presentation by Director Richard Whitman, Climate Impacts in the Pacific Northwest and Oregon's History of Greenhouse Gas Work. That will take 30 to 45 minutes, I believe, with questions from the committee members. Then we'll move to an update on the Clean Energy Jobs Work Group and chair reports. That will take another half hour, 40 minutes. At that point, the House Committee will move next door to Hearing Room E. We'll have a short break, and then that forum will hear an update on the place-based planning efforts on water management from around the state. Just prior to the break, but for those folks that are watching us on OLIS from at home in the comfort of your home, because you don't have anything better to do this morning, if you're watching online, you'll need to refresh your browser after the break, or you'll be, if you want to follow the House Committee, you'll need to refresh your browser, otherwise you get stuck with the Senate Committee and whatever they're doing.
But under the higher likelihood that you want to stay with the Senate, you will see us joined by the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources, where we'll be having a couple of informational hearings related to our forests. The first on advanced wood products, some of the research that's happening there, and then a look back on this past forest fire season and some of the lessons learned from that season. Thank
you. With that, unless we have any other housekeeping matters, which I don't see, we're good. Then we'll invite Director Whitman forward for our first part of the hearing. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Denbrough, Chair Helm, members of the committees. For the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you for inviting me here this morning to give you an overview of climate impacts in the Pacific Northwest and a very brief history of Oregon's work to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The first comprehensive assessment of climate risk in Oregon was done about 10 years ago under Governor Kulongoski, and this presentation this morning provides an update on that work from 10 years ago. There has been quite a bit of research done over that 10-year period, and in particular, the refinement of the climate models has occurred so that we're now able to predict at a much finer geographic scale what impacts are likely to occur where. So I'm going to talk a little bit about actually six types of impacts in the Pacific Northwest, focusing first on temperature and precipitation, which are the drivers for many of the other changes, but then also looking at changes in our snowpack and the hydrology of our rivers and streams. I'm also going to talk about wildfire, an issue that's, I know, of significant interest to this body, given the past year. I'm going to talk about vegetation change in our forest in particular, and I'm also going to talk about ocean acidification. So first of all, some basic terms. Representative Concentration Pathways, or RCPs, these are the climate models that scientists are using to predict changes in temperature and precipitation. And they have different assumptions depending on what the level of greenhouse gas reduction is. RCP 4.5 is a relatively optimistic scenario for projecting climate change, with emissions peaking in 2040 and then declining, and that's globally. And then RCP 8.5 is not the absolute worst case, but has emissions continuing to rise throughout the 21st century. So I'll continue to refer to those RCPs as I go here. First of all, starting with the basics, temperature. And I draw your attention to the numbers that are highlighted there. The projected changes in summer temperatures in 2080. Under the RCP 4.5 scenario, we're looking at a projected change in temperature during the summer of 5.5 degrees. Under the less optimistic climate model, we're actually looking at a summertime change of over 10 degrees. And then precipitation. And there are a couple of slides here. The first one here is wintertime precipitation, which is projected to increase in the Pacific Northwest over the next 75 years. That's the dark blue line that you see there. And then summertime precipitation, which is projected to decline in the Pacific Northwest, again shown in the dark blue line. Those changes in temperature and precipitation drive a number of other changes, which I'm now going to take you through. The first is actually something relatively new that just came out of the just published National Climate Assessment that was in the media in the last few weeks, which is looking at the likelihood of what are called atmospheric rivers. Those are those terrible wintertime storms that come for several days and just dump moisture on the West Coast. Those storms are projected to increase in their frequency fairly substantially on the West Coast. There is uncertainty about where they'll be directed, whether they'll flow more to the north or down into California. But overall, for the West Coast, we're looking at an increase of 30 to 40% in those rivers, with resulting impacts in terms of flooding in particular. So what do the changes in precipitation and temperature mean in terms of snowpack and hydrology? You've all heard before that our snowpack is our main source of water storage here in the state of Oregon rather than reservoirs. There are some rather startling numbers here from the, again, the National Climate Assessment that just came out, looking at changes in snow water equivalent. I believe this is as of April. In different mountain ranges in the western United States. So for the Cascades, we're looking at a decrease of between 40% and 90% in our snow water equivalent water stored in our snowpack. I should mention this is under the worst case or RCP 8.5 scenario. The numbers are a little bit better under RCP 4.5, but still fairly dramatic. Down in the Klamath, we're looking by the end of the century at almost a total loss of snowpack as a source of water storage. I want to talk next about wildfire. Again, obviously something that people felt firsthand this past summer, particularly in the western part of the state, and as shown by this slide, which shows the wildfire occurring as of early September in the Pacific Northwest and the resulting smoke from wildfire. So again, there are a number of recent science reports on causes of wildfire. I know this is a matter of some controversy, the degree to which wildfire is caused by climate is opposed to being caused by changes in forest management practices. Is opposed to changes in our settlement patterns and where houses are located. Those are all causes. But the recent science shows that climate change is a key driver in terms of the increase in wildfire. And you're going to see a little bit more about this issue of climate versus forest management in a minute. So this, again, is a recent study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that shows roughly about half of the increase in wildfire in the Pacific Northwest has been caused by human-caused climate change through 2015. Okay, so the change in temperature, change in precipitation, and wildfire all drive changes in projected vegetation types in the Pacific Northwest. And one of the things that, again, has come out in some recent science is change in forest cover in Pacific Northwest, and in particular, change in the extent of our Douglas fir forests, which are the key forest type for Western Oregon and Southern Oregon as well. So I'm going to talk about some of those changes. Models suggest that, in general, Douglas fir forests are going to shift to the east, and that the forest in Western Oregon and Western Washington will shift to more of a mixed conifer forest with hardwoods as well. So these are some of the modeled types of forests. This is the historic forest type modeled using these climate models looking back. And the FS and NFS stand for fire with fire suppression and without fire suppression. So this science looks directly at how much of the vegetation change is a result of climate and how much is a result of what we do in terms of fire suppression. So here are the numbers for RCP 4.5. Again, this is the middle of the range climate projection with greenhouse gas emissions starting to decline in 2040. And you'll see, I'll go back, the dark green historic is the conifer forest. By the latter part of this century, that forest is projected to shift to the east and be replaced by cool mixed forest on our coast, as well as warm mixed forest on our on the very coastal part of the region. And then under the less optimistic climate change scenario, RCP 8.5, you'll see the forest type changes even more dramatically to warm mixed forest, more typical of what we now see in California.
Richard, can you go back a slide real quick? So am I correct in understanding that under this scenario, could we consider these maps to be the sort of baked-in consequences of having not reacted to climate change up to this point sufficiently? We talk about how long carbon is going to stay, CO2 is going to linger in our atmosphere, and how baked in the impacts of climate change already are. And we have kind of assumed that we're stuck with what we have now out to 2040. Is it your understanding from looking at the literature and this information that we I'm trying to phrase this correctly so as not to lead you to a conclusion, but should we look at this as the likely scenario for Oregon and Washington?
Chair Hell, members of the committee, I've done a lot of reading over the last year on this subject. I am not a scientist, but there are many scientific articles that predict that the fundamental nature of our forestry in Western Oregon is going to change, and it's going to change from a Douglas fir dominated softwood lumber, which we lead the nation in, to more of what we see in California, much less productive forest. And to answer your question, this RCP 4.5 assumes that greenhouse gas emissions globally will start to decline in 2040. We're going to be very fortunate to hit that mark. That will take very aggressive action throughout the planet to get to that scenario. Mm-hmm. RCP 8.5, which is the next one, is sort of more our current trajectory without any real significant improvement. So somewhere between those is probably the likely scenario where we're going to end up. And so I know folks in our forest industry and our universities are working hard already on what we can do to adapt to changing temperature and moisture. We're working on genetically modifying Douglas fir to make it more suitable for drier and warmer climates. But even if we do that, the productivity of our forests are going to go down because it is going to be drier and it is going to be warmer. And those are the main limiting factors.
Thank you.
So this is another study, and I'll show these slides in a little bit more detail, but this is looking at the shift in Douglas fir, both in the western U.S., but also in western Canada. And one of the takeaways from these reports is that our Douglas fir forests are shifting north and into Canada. And I think, you know, some of our forest products companies already own and are, I think, acquiring lands in Canada, in British Columbia, to anticipate this change. But again, for Oregon, in terms of our economy, this has some significant consequences. So this is a table showing information from the same study. It shows the Douglas fir forest in British Columbia increasing from a little under 200,000 acres to almost 500,000 acres, and a decline in the U.S. from just under 800,000 acres to just over 400,000 acres by 2090. Okay, so those are the impacts in terms of vegetation change. I want to talk briefly about ocean acidification, and again, I don't have a lot of slides on this, but there is a high level of confidence. Again, this is under the recently released National Climate Assessment, that under the higher scenario, RCP 8.5, global average surface ocean acidity is projected to increase by 100% to 150%, and that's by the end of this century. So significant consequences for our fisheries, and particularly our shellfish industries. So bottom line, what are the consequences of all these changes in natural resources? There are consequences for public health. We saw the short-term consequences this summer from wildfire smoke, and that's nothing new for many parts of our state. Also changes in heat create health risks, particularly for the elderly. And then also the increase in temperature leads to an increase in vectors for disease, both in terms of our vegetation and also for people. Damage to private and public property in terms of fire and floods. Again, we've seen some of that this past year. And then economic implications of all these changes. And this is something I want to highlight here. With climate change forcing changes in our natural resources in particular, it's our rural communities that are dependent on those natural resources, whether those be forest resources or water resources, even agricultural resources that are dependent on water, or fisheries that are going to be hit the hardest by climate change. There will be also significant reductions in water supplies during the summer and early fall. I talked about the change in snowpack. There will be some positives for agriculture in Oregon with increasing temperature. One of the limiting factors for agriculture in Oregon is temperature, but it will be counterbalanced by the decreases in water supply, particularly during the summer and early fall. And then, for the Department of Environmental Quality in particular, there are consequences around the changes in hydrology and temperature for our water quality. We're seeing increases in average stream temperatures already, and we're seeing changes in aquatic habitat in terms of algal blooms to a limited extent here in Oregon, but actually elsewhere in the nation, we're seeing conditions in terms of those blooms that are actually creating public health threats. And then finally, I'll mention intergenerational equity. Obviously, a concern here, going back to your question, Chair Helm, is we're already on a trajectory where we're going to see significant impacts for our children. If we do not act relatively quickly here to start doing our part to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, those consequences could be quite severe. So let me talk briefly about how we're doing in Oregon in terms of controlling greenhouse gas emissions. There has been some success in Oregon. So as you all know, our legislative goal for greenhouse gas reductions is a 10% reduction by 2020 and further a 75% reduction, and that's below 1990 levels, by 2050. So basically, we are a bit above our 1990 greenhouse gas emissions right now, 12% higher than 1990. So we are not going in the right direction in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, even though we have made some progress. I want to focus in a little bit on cause. The Global Warming Commission, in its latest report to the legislature, really focused in on transportation, and a couple of slides here really portray what's going on. So it's particularly the uptick in greenhouse gas emissions from transportation in the last several years that have gotten us significantly off track for our 2020 goal. And then focusing in a little bit more closely, in particular, it's greenhouse gas emissions from diesel in particular that have increased the fastest in terms of transportation greenhouse gas emissions. So that is emissions primarily from our freight sector that are driving that increase in greenhouse gas emissions. So what have we done? What are we doing right now? Oregon Governor Brown recently issued an executive order on further steps by Oregon agencies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but this legislature has been active in taking steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions for really the last 20 years, starting with standards that were put in place for fossil fuel power plants back in 1997. But some of the particular more recent actions, action in 2007 to establish our state goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in House Bill 3543. Adoption of zero emission and low emission vehicle standards by the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission. That's adopting California's vehicle emission standards back in several iterations starting in 2005. And then more recently in this last legislative session, action in House Bill 2017, the transportation bill, to provide some significant incentives for faster acquisition of electrical vehicles. The Coal to Clean Bill in 2016, Senate Bill 1457, that has us transitioning off of coal by 2030 and increasing the renewable portfolio standard to 50%. The Clean Fuels Program, which was authorized in 2009 and then further refined in the transportation bill in this last session, that has us achieving a 10% reduction in carbon emissions from fuels by 2025. 2010 legislation and Senate Bill 1059 for the Oregon Sustainable Transportation Initiative, which is focused on reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation in our metropolitan areas. And then finally, mandatory greenhouse gas reporting in 2008, 2010 Environmental Quality Commission rules. So Oregon has done a lot to address greenhouse gas emissions, but as you saw in the prior slides, we are basically at best level in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, actually increasing slightly in the last several years. So we're not headed in the right direction to do our part in terms of hitting the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions we need to in order to avoid some of the impacts that I've shown you today that are predicted in recent scientific studies. So with that, I'll close, and I'd be happy to answer questions from the committee.
Questions from committee members.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Whitman. I apologize for getting here a little bit late. I have here in front of me 2014, 15, and 16 greenhouse gas emissions from the DEQ. There are a few industries that show some upticks, but most of them are showing a substantial decline. The one I like to use the best is Ash Grove Cement. This is done without mandates and without us pushing them to do that. But in your discussion, has anyone taken into account the fact that from 1990 to now, we've added 1.2 million citizens to our state?
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, and Senator Olson, the legislative goals that were adopted for greenhouse gas emissions were adopted knowing that the population of Oregon was going to increase, and yet the legislature established a goal of a 10% reduction by 2020. So while it is true that on a per capita basis emissions have gone down, we still are not doing what we need to do to meet the legislative goals that this body established.
I've got a double follow-up. Thank you. Well, in the legislative considerations, do you think that the legislature at that time took into account the 50,000 citizens that move to Oregon every year, which in fact we don't count their CO2 output, but they certainly bring mechanization, require infrastructure and everything. Do you think they took that into account when they were considering the 10% reduction?
Chair Helm, Chair Dembro, and Senator Olson, I believe it was well known at the time those legislative goals were adopted that the population of Oregon was going to increase substantially over those years.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Whitman, you gave us a lot of charts there showing the changes in Western Oregon, particularly in the forest, and you did mention, you know, obviously some of the water issues with the warming. Do you have corresponding numbers for temperature increases to our streams, particularly the coastal streams, that correspond to that same time frame?
Co-Chair Dembro, or Chair Helm, and Representative Holvey, I do not have those with me today, but I do have in the, I believe it's the most recent report from the Oregon Climate Change Resource Institute at OSU, they do show projected changes in stream temperature and actually other water quality issues affecting fisheries in our streams over time. So if you like, I'd be happy to follow up with you and get you that information.
Thank you.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, and I will have a follow-up as well. Good morning, Director. Thank you for the presentation. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, a few things. You mentioned if we do not act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, impacts will be severe, considering that Oregon produces 0.14%, according to the Global Warming Commission, to the global climate issue. If we were to reduce greenhouse emissions in Oregon to zero, what impact would that play in the scenario that you just laid out for us?
Chair Helm, Chair Dembro, Representative Brock Smith, yes, you are correct that Oregon's proportion of global carbon emissions is, I'll use the word, minuscule. So in terms of the effect on people directly, the real issue is what happens globally in terms of carbon emissions. And so that is why Oregon Governor Brown feels as a matter of equity that we need to do our part to reduce CO2 emissions. And so if everybody does their part, then we can avoid the consequences that I showed this morning.
Follow up. Thank you very much. To lead by example, once again, that narrative. So with the water slide that you had on page 5 that shows that we're going to have a significant rain increases, but drought during the summer. And, of course, our current storage scenarios are utilizing snowpack, which your plan is what you presented here shows that that's going to be limiting. Don't you think that the state should be, rather than concentrating on what you just mentioned, minuscule, that we look at investing in water storage, such as reservoirs, for our farmers and ranchers so that we can produce food for those folks that will be less fortunate in climate conditions? And then when it comes to, you mentioned that the forest in Western Oregon, or my district, will be less productive. And you talked about the wildfire smoke being nothing new. Don't you think that, as the director of DEQ, we have a situation where we know that there's changing conditions? I don't think anybody disputes that. We dispute the method on which I believe, and I can only speak for myself, where Oregon can lead by example and how we do so. But with the changing conditions, to go back to forest management practices, don't you think that it would be prudent for us as a state to adapt those forest policies so that we can maximize the very sequestering trees, carbon sequestering trees that are sequestering those greenhouse emissions in rural Oregon? Because you did mention that rural Oregon will be hit the hardest. And so by changing those policies, we could then not only save rural Oregon, grow rural Oregon, but also sequester more carbon rather than letting it burn up and releasing all that sequestered greenhouse emissions.
Chair Helm, Chair Dembrough, Representative Brocksmith, I agree with both of your propositions that Oregon should be investing more in water storage. I know Governor Brown agrees as well, and that's why in her governor's budget she has put money into infrastructure for water storage projects across the state. I think everybody agrees that Oregon, because of the inevitability of these changes, is going to need to invest in that infrastructure over time. Secondly, in terms of forest practices, I said at the outset that forest practices have an impact on fire along with climate change. And I personally would agree that active management to promote forest health and reduce the severity of wildfire is a wise and necessary step for us to be taking as well to do what we can to adapt to these coming conditions. Part of the point of my presentation, though, was to show that even with that work, we are still going to see very significant changes in our forest that are going to have, I am afraid, severe economic consequences for rural Oregon as well as public health consequences. And so in terms of my role as director of DEQ, yes, I think we do need to be taking steps for more prescribed burning, more thinning to reduce the risk of wildfire.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart and then Senator Roman.
Thank you. I think the witness answered most of my question. I would simply note that if we're going to take the kind of steps that will lead to our grandchildren being able to successfully live in Oregon or probably anywhere else, it's going to require the concerted effort of states and countries around the world to do the kinds of things that will lead to the cessation of adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and the kinds of activities in adaption that will lead to a reduction of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere over time. I'm confident that current technology will allow us to do both of those things if we get on with it. Rather than discussing how small Oregon's contribution is to both the problem and the solution, we need to be acknowledging that, but at the same time, doing our piece to make it happen and expecting others to do the same. And around the world, in fact, others are doing much better than we are at both of those activities right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Robel.
Thank you very much, and thanks for being here, Richard. When I look at the best-case scenario and I look at the changes that are going to happen with our coastal forests, adaptation becomes, for me, the number one goal. So we have to look forward and say, are there, in this new forest arrangement, are there new kinds of trees we should be planting? Should we anticipate it? Because it doesn't look like we're going to change much in the best-case scenario. So as our forests grow, do we have a plan for what we put back? I mean, do we just keep planting Douglas fir that's going to die because it's too hot, or do we find the next advantageous kinds of trees or other things that would grow that would also keep streams cooler, those other kinds of things? Or do we just keep hanging on to the thing that we know, if that's correct, are going to die out? I mean, what kinds of plans are we making with respect to what we're going to do to adapt to these new conditions?
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, and Senator Robel, that's an excellent question. And I'll do my best to give you what I understand about it, but I would also invite you to talk to folks at Oregon State and also folks in the forest industry about what they are doing now to anticipate and adapt, because I know the forest industry is looking at these issues and looking at what can be done to adapt. So looking at particular subspecies of Douglas fir that are better adapted to drier and warmer climate is one thing that is going on already, but also looking at other conifer species that are also better adapted. So replacing Douglas fir with pine and other species like that. The issue is, however, even though you could still have a forest, a healthy and productive forest on the Oregon coast, it is going to be different. It is going to be less productive in terms of the volume of wood that is produced per unit of area. And that's because of the drier conditions and the change in hydrology, and also the very hot conditions during the summer. Those are limiting factors for tree growth that are going to reduce how much wood we produce from our forests. So while we can adapt to some extent, that's going to drive some changes in our economy in terms of types of mills and density of timber infrastructure that we can support from those forests.
And I guess this is one not necessarily for our state, but as I looked at BC and the others gaining forest, our agreement between Canada and the U.S. with softwood lumber probably is something we need to look at fairly closely, because that might be the only place that has softwood lumber at some point. So I'm a little kind of, I mean, it's interesting that the national issues are also part of what we have to deal with. Just a comment.
Representative Dentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your work on this, Director. That I note in that last slide that the measure, at least of this presentation, of success is the reduction in CO2. Yet I think this conversation we're having here would suggest there's many other measures that should be applied. Yet, as you know, I brought a bill the last four or five sessions on climate metrics in a vain attempt to figure out how to measure success. What I see here is almost as long as we reduce CO2, everything's going to be fine, and of course that's not true. We know that because of the conversations about adaptation, how well we're doing there is equally important. Where is your department when it comes to providing those measures of success that take into account many things other than just this shallow attempt at saying we're winning, which I call reduction in CO2, because there's so much more going on in this space. You mentioned it worldwide, and one of the things I've suggested in the past is there's this assertion that if we join California, somehow there'll be a synergistic result. That where's the study? Where are those metrics? And otherwise, how can we, if you don't have them, expect you to explain to us what we should be doing that we're not?
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, I think in the end what we all care about are what's happening in our environment. What are the environmental outcomes that we all care about? And this body created the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at OSU that provides regular reporting to this legislative body on the types of metrics that I think you're interested in. And I would direct you to their regular reports that look at how our environment is changing or not changing in terms of stream flow, in terms of our forest, in terms of our agriculture, all those outcome metrics that directly measure the impacts on everyday Oregonians. And they're the experts on these things. They were, as I said, chartered by this legislature.
Let me put a finer point on it. You have a department that has a budget, and you have to decide how you're going to focus your efforts on our behalf. So what metrics are you using to make those decisions? It's fine for you to refer me to that which other people are doing, but I'm asking you, because you're in charge of that department, and how can you assure us that you're spending our money as wisely as possible if you don't have those studies? I mean, when one comes in and makes these suggestions to us that we're doing the right thing, we justifiably ask, how do we know you're telling us the best thing we can do with our limited resources? Seriously, because I think all of us understand that which you put on the board, if true, is hugely concerning. So shouldn't we be asking you the really tough questions about how do you know you're investing our money the best if you don't have these metrics? So just share with me what you look at when you decide that we're going to focus all of our money on CO2 reduction, as opposed to what? Putting all the money into OSU and coming up with some type of new technology that perhaps would solve these problems better. I mean, just share with me how we know we're doing the best to solve the problems you've so interestingly illustrated today.
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, as I think you know, Representative, the budget for the Department of Environmental Quality is set by the legislature, and we are provided with fairly specific amounts of money to do specific things. There are a few of those things that are related to climate, but for the most part, our budget is dedicated toward controlling air emissions and controlling water pollution in our state, and that's how we are directed to spend our money. The question of, I don't have the freedom as an agency director to target money to optimize greenhouse gas reduction. That is not the mandate that I'm given by the legislature.
I need to move on.
Thank you.
Senator Przanski.
Thank you. Richard, thank you again for being here. I want to follow up with Senator Roblin's question. Knowing that we're going to see a significant change in our softwood production, knowing that we're going to be into, I'm going to call it some type of mixed wood, those mixed woods, from my understanding, take less time for production levels in the sense of being able to be harvested. Now, maybe that's wrong. It sounds like maybe your eyebrows are telling me that's not quite. Can you just clarify for me what has been taken into consideration there? Because I was under the impression that, yes, we're going to see a significant downturn in our softwood, but some of it may be offset, not to the same level. Could you elaborate a little bit?
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, Senator Przanski, the reduction in Doug fir forest will be replaced to some degree by other forest types, but the productivity in terms of wood produced by those forests will be less. I didn't include it in my presentation, but one of the studies that I drew this presentation from looks at site productivity index for forest in western Oregon over time, and you're looking at fairly significant decreases in productivity generally for forest production, again because of less water and hotter summertime temperatures.
Thank you. I need to move on. I'm sorry. Director, thank you very much for this presentation. We appreciate it. And folks, at this point in our agenda, we're going to move to a discussion of the Clean Energy Jobs work groups and a brief report out by each of the chairs of those work groups. And before we do that, I noted that Senator Dembrough may have had a statement or a question Director Whitman that I failed to acknowledge.
That's fine, Chair Helm. The comment that I was going to make really, I think, helps provide a bridge for this. And, you know, just as kind of background to the clean energy jobs work, this was a process that began, well, it began several years ago, but it began in earnest, really, during the 2016 session. Most or all of you here participated in a series of meetings throughout the 16 session looking at potential strategies for pricing greenhouse gas emissions in an effort to cap greenhouse gas pollution, starting to move that needle down to get us to the goals where we heard from the Oregon Climate Research Institute, where we needed to go, where we were hearing from Global Warming Commission that we were not on track to hit those goals unless we took more aggressive action. And so we, as you'll recall, looked at that from a number of perspectives, including how capping greenhouse gas emission, we could do it in a way that would not hurt our economy, but would actually benefit our economy, particularly our rural economies. And we queried experts in the field, people from those other jurisdictions that have been moving in this direction, California, Ontario, Quebec, et cetera. And at the end of the session, we realized, of course, that we were not going to be able to finalize this work during the 2016 session, but we had come to a number of conclusions that would allow us to draft a bill, which became Senate Bill 1070, that could serve as the framework for ongoing work. We knew if we were going to continue this in the 2018 session, of course, being a short session, we needed to do much, much, much work during the interim, at least as much work during the interim as would otherwise happen during a long session. And to that end, we created these work groups. And I think the last time we talked to you, colleagues, about them, they had not yet met. And we didn't know what the participation would be. And in fact, as many of you know, the participation has been quite robust in these work groups. We had hundreds participating in each of these work groups, either in person, on the phone, people from industry, experts, advocates, just a real range. And I really want to thank everyone who participated in this, notably our chairs, the work group chairs, three of whom are up here on the dais, and one is back there in the back. And why don't you come up now, Senator Beyer, and we can move into that. You know, the question came up before of what little Oregon could do in this process, where we're really talking about a global concern. And, you know, I think that, the notion of leading by example, I think, is an important element. You know, I think we have a kind of ethical responsibility, each of us, to, if there's a problem, we all, no matter what city we live in, what state we live in, what country we live in, we have to do what we can to address this problem. And so it's a kind of ethical issue, I think, that we have to take a stand and do what we can for the sake of future generations. But I think there is also a very practical reason in terms of, you know, when you're thinking of leading by example, because, you know, we all know how this legislative process works. If other states have taken a step and, you know, we see that it has been working for them, then it makes us more prone to take that chance. States affect other states' actions. And that's why, you know, I believe that it's so important for us to follow up on what California has done. And, you know, the other interesting and important timing issue here is, as many of you know, California has just renewed its commitment to its Cap and Invest program in a way that was attracted broad support from its business community, broad support from its cities and counties and regions, and broad support, more than two-thirds of its legislature, bipartisan support. But the question is, where is the next state to carry that? And, you know, I think given all the work that we have done here in Oregon, we are poised, I think, to be the next state. And then, you know, Washington, the Northeast states. And we're really starting to make a difference because I think, as we all know, this work is not going to come out of Washington, D.C. anytime soon, and which heightens our responsibility as states. Anyway, that's what I was going to say before, and so I just wanted to kind of use that as a transition to this. I can tell you that the work that these work groups have been tackling has been, you know, very, very serious, very complex, but it has, I believe, the potential to make a real difference. I promised the Senate President during the summer that we would do this in a way where we would be creating a policy that could be a model for other states, but also doing it in a way where the process that we used to do this work could be a model for other states, a model of transparency and hard work and frankness. And, you know, I think that's what we've been seeing. So back to you.
Would you like to start off, or should we get Senator Beyer?
We could do Senator Beyer, and Brett Fernandez is here, too.
Let's
Yeah, we should probably let Senator Beyer, because he's got to go back to his other meeting.
Right. So we'll start the work group chair report outs with Senator Beyer's work group. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Dembo, Chair Helm. For the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator, and I had the I think it's an honor.
Short straw.
Having to convening the Transportation and Utilities Work Group. I will start off by saying it's each of the three meetings that we had were incredibly well attended. In fact, I think it was standing room only in room 50 downstairs for each of our meetings. Good participation, good discussion across the time. Important to me was there was no one who suggested we shouldn't do something to reduce greenhouse gases. I mean, there's pretty much consensus that we needed to do something. Having said that, getting into the meat of it proved to be a little more difficult as you try to get into it. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about transportation. I'm not sure why. I think there's general agreement on transportation that the future we're trying to achieve is moving more of the passenger fleet, particularly onto EVs. But that's more of an assumption on my part than I think that we had a robust discussion on that. Most of our discussion focused on the utilities, the electrical and the natural gas. Let me start off with the natural gas because I think it's easiest. On the natural gas side, we spent a lot of time talking about what's the right point of regulation. And one of the things we discovered is that our three distribution companies have the load that they serve, and they argue, and I think persuasively, that that's what they should be responsible for. But they also, like the interstate transportation pipelines, carry gas for others, and they made the point that they have no control over that gas input. And so I think we came to general agreement that the point of regulation on those should be the marketers, and I believe the number was there are 9 marketers, and we would have to attach them. So your point of regulation would be for their load, the 3 load-serving gas companies, and for direct service industries, it would be the 9 marketers. The other point on natural gas is, as you might imagine, it's very hard for them to do anything to reduce emissions. And so they have made a fairly good case that anything, if we want to deal with that, deal with emissions, we need to change some of the rules and create some incentives to allow them to take steps and go upstream in some cases to do that, or invest more in things like biogas facilities, or get more into energy efficiency. And I think the utilities each pointed out that in terms of energy efficiency, through the 2 pieces of legislation that we have created, that currently we are spending somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 7% of ratepayer bills going on promoting energy efficiency. So we have pretty good investment going there. So that's natural gas. On the electrical side, life gets harder in trying to figure that one out. Obviously, we did a lot, as I was just catching Richard's presentation. We've been doing a lot in that era already. And part of the concern of the, particularly the 2, we only really heard of 2 of the 3 investor-owned utilities, was making sure that our clean fuels program and the cap and trade, if we go there, work together and are not to the disadvantage of customers, per se. One of the things that I think we realized is that it's very hard to send an effective price signal to customers because they really don't have much choice in the matter. So it's hard to do that other than on energy efficiency. A little easier for large commercial and industrial customers, practically impossible to affect retail residential customers, and particularly those who are renters, which would take up a lot of the lower income customers on that. Point of regulation is for the consumer-owned utilities, they're very clear in their opinion that whatever we do, if it's incentives or allowances, they should get them because they have locally elected boards and they should deal with that. I think a common assumption is that the consumer-owned utilities, for as a practical matter, are all BPA customers, and so everything they get is renewable power in one sense. If it's hydro, it's either hydro or one of the other renewables or nuke. One thing that I think is not as clear is that there's a piece of the power source that's called balancing, which is in each of the utilities, depending on literally a minute-by-minute system, they may have to buy power outside, and in many cases, they really don't know where that power comes from. So that's a piece. I think the DEQ has suggested that they do that on an allocation basis. So that's theirs. The COUs, there are approximately 3 of them that are large enough to fall under bigger control. The rest of them are fairly small. On the IOUs, and I'm really not talking about Idaho Power because they really haven't been part of the discussion at this point, but it's really we're talking about Pacific Power and PGE, and it differs between the 2. Again, they're both on pretty good tracks to do moving out of the coal business completely. The issue for them is, and I think they advocated, they would prefer to get the allowances directly rather than have them sold in the marketplace. They believe that allows them to better control the rates and the concerns on their customers. I think that's their argument. If not that, then their next is to have some type of hybrid system where they get part of them allocated and part of them may be sold. And obviously, we're always talking about over time a declining slope. So there's some discussion on how you define that slope and who does it. Do we do it through statute, or do we allow the the commission to do it through rule, and if through rule, how much specific direction, principal direction we give them on how to do that, recognizing that we have an overall goal that we've talked about to hit the reduction, but it will differ between the companies, between the utilities and how they get there because of where they're starting from. The point of regulation, I think it's easier for PGE because most of theirs is resources are in-state. They have some of the coal, is a coal strip in Montana, but it's easier for them in-state. For Pacific Core, it's harder, and one of the elements that we discovered is, you know, I think there's an overall attempt to try to mirror California, but we discovered the relationship of the grid is very different in California than it is in Oregon. And Oregon, for Pacific Core, understand that they have six states that they deliver power to through an integrated system, and I think their comment to us is we will meet the commitment, but we're not going to change the way we operate the system. So they're arguing on an allocation basis, and outside of our meetings, but the two chairs and I had a chance to meet with them, and one of the things that they comment to us is that most of their power during the day is now coming in from California as part of the market system called the EIM there, where there's a surplus of solar power during the middle of the day that they need to get rid of, they being California, and that's coming north, and they are balancing the California system in the evenings with their coal system, which they're operating in a different manner. They don't operate in what's called base load anymore. They operate on a level, and they follow the load. That's called load following on system on that. So that's a little distinction that I think at least the three of us, when we talked to them, kind of went away going, not sure how that all works together, how we're going to do that. But that's a complicated matter that I'm sure we'll get to. We just don't have a recommendation on it at this point. So I think that's pretty high level over the top is...
Perfect. Thank you, Senator. And we've allocated about 20 minutes for all the chair report out. So I'm going to ask the committee, I think, if you have specific questions for any of the chairs of the work groups, to direct those questions to the chairs outside of the hearing.
One more comment. If I may, Mr. Chair, it strikes me that I think we need to keep in mind that what we're trying to do is encourage whoever it is that's emitting greenhouse gases to reduce it as quickly as they can. And I think we have to, at least I believe, that the actors who are in the best position to do that are probably the utilities. And beyond just compliance in their declining line, we need to think about how we incent them. One of the issues that became clear to me, and it's probably because of my background in working with utilities, I think we're going to have to think about changing the guidance we give to the Public Utility Commission, because I think some of the guidance as a strict economic regulator precludes them from encouraging decarbonizing the system as rapidly as we can. So I think we need to give some thought to how we do that and what incentives we could put in place. It strikes me that if you allow them to do some upstream kinds of things and get some offset credit, that might get us to the end goal faster and more cheaply.
Mr. Chair, one comment. For all the chairs of the work groups, did you do any work whatsoever on rate implications to consumers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, saying we did work on it would be an overstatement. Saying we discussed it a lot, and that's what I was trying to get at in terms of the utilities talking about how to get there, and particularly how to get there under the regime of a cap and trade without complicating the already instructions on getting out of the coal, under the clean coal business.
All right. Thank you, Senator Beyer.
Thank you.
Would you like to go next?
Yeah, mine really is a natural next.
I'm going to go back to my committee.
Very good. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, I chair the committee on regulated entities, those industries that will be regulated under this proposed system. And so it really complements what Senator Beyer was saying. And just to use Senator Olson's question as kind of a bridge, we do have to distinguish between rates and cost. we want to create a system that minimizes the cost of compliance, irrespective of what happens with rates, so that, you know, rates will send a signal that, you know, a company that takes advantage of technology in order to become more efficient and in order to at the same time be more productive could actually benefit financially from this system. And that's part of our goal, so that early adopters actually are rewarded under this system. And, you know, those who come to, you know, reducing their, you know, their emissions more quickly can actually benefit through the market that's being created. We're seeing that happen already in other jurisdictions. You know, I do want to, before I go into this, just remind everyone that what's envisioned under Senate Bill 1070 is a two or probably three, in the bill right now, it's a three-year rulemaking program design period after the bill is passed. And that is obviously important in order to give the people working on the programs the time to develop them, but also to allow industries to prepare for it and to, you know, create their strategies. And that really is foremost in our thinking of how to deal with those industries that are being regulated. Another promise I made to the Senate President was that in creating this program, we would be creating a program that would not hurt Oregon's economy, that would actually benefit Oregon's economy. And as we think about how we're going to handle these regulated industries, we really need to think about that. So we spent a lot of time in my work group thinking about the impacts on the regulated entities, and particularly those that are the large emitters. Those entities that are regulated under this program are those that emit more than 25,000 tons of carbon annually, and that's the real focus. And we received a report from DEQ with updated data on who would be included in that group. And they fall into several different areas. Utilities, of course, which we've already heard about, the natural gas, imported transportation fuels, okay, those fuels that come into the state, and then about 50 industries. You know, for example, steel, pulp and paper, food processing. Those are industries that pollute, that emit at this level. And one of the real challenges that we face in dealing with a program like this is avoiding what within the smart people they call it leakage. And that is the concern that companies that are currently emitting at this level, if you regulate them and bring them under a program in such a way that they're either going to go out of business or more likely move to another state and emit in that other state, it's really not doing anybody any good because this is a global problem, and we need to be really careful about that. And those entities that we have to really focus on are those that are called the EITEs, the Emissions Intensive Trade Exposed, those that emit at very high levels. And we need to get them to bring down those levels, but they are under very heavy competitive pressures from other states or other countries. So we really have to focus on those. And we looked to the other states and jurisdictions, met by phone with people from California, Quebec, and Ontario, and learned that in setting up a program like this, we really, if we're following their lead, and of course we don't have to do it exactly the same way they did, but we can learn from the way they did it. We need to think in terms of getting these industries on a downward slope, not something that is going to be so abrupt that it's going to put them out of business or force them to another state, but is going to be on a down path that's very predictable and very clear, and it's something that they can adjust to. And if they do, again, as I said earlier, if they're able to make those technical fixes early enough, and perhaps we can use some of the revenues from the program to help them to get there, then they will actually benefit financially from this what we're trying to do. So that's what we're working on right now, is trying to find that sort of sweet spot to deal with these EITEs. There are some other cost control elements that are already in the bill, and the work group kind of confirmed that, yes, that those are all things we want to keep in the program. A major one is linking to other jurisdictions, the Western Climate Initiative jurisdictions, currently California and Ontario and Quebec, and then there are some others that are thinking of joining. Having the allowances that are part of this program, having a predictable price floor for these allowances, allowing entities to bank allowances over a certain period within certain restrictions, but again, in a very predictable manner, and allowing the overall program to have a reserve so that we don't have to worry about price spikes for the cost of allowances. So keeping it steady, keeping it predictable. Right now, the cost of allowances within the Western Climate Initiative is, I think it's about $13 or $14 a ton, and that's predicted to rise in a very, a slow, steady manner in order not to create undue shocks to the system. And it's believed that that is a methodology that can be really successful. So that's the broad overview of regulated entities.
Thank you, Senator. I think I'll move next to Representative Hernandez and Representative Marsh, who co-chaired the Just Transition and Environmental Justice Work Group.
Great. Chair Helm, Chair Dembrough, for the record, my name is Diego Hernandez, State Rep, House District 47, East Portland. I'll just give a quick overview, and Representative Marsh will follow with a little bit more detail. So we were tasked with environmental justice and just transition, and we had specific things that we were tasked with, and some of those were to define impacted communities as well as figure out where best to put our investments based on our definition, but also the metrics that are important in terms of making sure that folks stay in jobs, those that are most impacted by climate change and have historically been impacted, get also an opportunity to have a healthy environment, but also access to new opportunities in jobs. We also were tasked with furthering defining just transition, Representative Marsh will talk a little bit more about the subgroups that did a lot of the deep diving into this work. One of the other major tasks as well was looking at the governance and transparency component of the legislation and figuring out, I would say, a much more efficient and clear steps for that. It was a pretty ambitious agenda, to be honest. We did have four separate subgroups or subcommittees. I felt like we needed maybe a committee on committees just to track everything. But it was really well attended, and we had some great participation from a variety of different types of organizations and also advocacy groups.
Thank you, Diego. I'll just add a little bit more detail. I think first it's perhaps valuable to take just a step back and to note that when we talk about cap and invest, we're talking a lot about the cap, which is obviously setting the clear policy direction for our state, and we hope in the process of doing that spurring some kinds of innovation and technical responses that will allow us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions across the state. But there's also the invest part, which is the opportunity part. And a lot of the work of our subcommittee really focused on that investment, recognizing that investments from the flow of money that's created through the cap allowance system needs to be used to do climate mitigation and adaptation policies. But it's also an opportunity to really look at individuals and communities that are most impacted by climate and to assist them in the coming times and to really look at what kinds of investments we need to make so that we all move together into the new economy. So we started off, we really had three big questions that we looked at. First, we tried to define what are going to be the most impacted individuals and communities across the state of Oregon. We put together a small subcommittee to look at that, and they used a Portland State study that's just been completed that really looks exactly at that question, identifying a number of parameters, including the percentage of non-white population, income parameters, age parameters, employment parameters. And they took that work and they identified census tracts across the state that really fit that definition of most impacted communities that again, was compiled by looking at a variety of very specific indicators. So with that, we are able to really map across the state of Oregon those communities that will be most impacted so that a significant proportion of the funding allocations that we put forward would be able to target those communities. The second question we looked at was what kinds of investments can we best make to impact and to assist those communities? Again, we had another subcommittee, and they came up with a set of recommendations that really define how we should be looking at spending those monies. We weren't trying to identify projects, but really we were just trying to identify the parameters that will guide our investments. I'm not going to go into the detail of those, but they include, just to give you a flavor for those kinds of parameters, that we want to help communities that are dependent on natural resources to develop and adopt sustainable practices, that we want to facilitate the research and development of clean energy infrastructure and technology, that we want to promote low carbon economic development opportunities. Those are just a few of the kind of parameters that clearly would benefit impacted communities. And then the third area that we looked at that Diego mentioned briefly was the issue of governance and transparency. The bill in its initial state was, I would say, overburdened with different kinds of decision-making bodies. We wanted to streamline that. We also really wanted to make sure that our environmental justice and just transition communities are well represented in the decision-making process from the very beginning, and we have a specific set of recommendations in that regard as well. So without taking time to go into details, that gives you an overview of the work that was conducted by this committee, and would be glad to provide details for anybody who would like to know exactly what we produced.
Very good. Thank you. And I'll back clean up by reporting out on the Agriculture, Forestry, Fisheries, Tribes, and Rural Communities work group. Before I get into the meat of that, I wanted to let everyone that is in paying attention to this hearing, either here in person or through OLIS, that all of the materials for all of the work groups that have been submitted
or utilized during the work group process are posted on the websites of Senator Dembro and myself on our legislative website under Clean Energy Jobs. So if you go to our legislative website, there will be a category there on the front page that will get you to Clean Energy Jobs, and you can find all of the materials that have been submitted up to this point. My work group focused heavily on two areas. One is the potential for what are called offsets in Oregon, and then what we may need to do both in terms of actions and investment to mitigate the impacts of climate change through adaptation. We learned quite a bit about how other states and Quebec and Ontario have approached the offset market. Offsets have been part of a cap-and-trade program for many, many years, and they are they're a desired option of some of the folks that are some of the entities that are affected, essentially to help hedge the cost of compliance so that there is a release valve from the credit market itself as another mechanism for complying, and hopefully for them, cheaper. The benefit of an offset market is what can actually happen on the ground. And what we found most commonly was offset programs that are attached to forests. And those are agreements, long-term agreements, with forest owners to manage their forests in certain ways to sequester as much carbon as is agreed to over the time period. For forests, it has been typically about 100 years. The agreements do not mandate a no-cut scenario in those forests. It mandates management of a healthy forest where the amount of growth is predictable, the carbon sequestration capability is known and measured. What typically happens is longer rotations management that occurs along the way so that the forests continue to be working forests to some degree. We learned about how offset programs have worked in the dairy sector through dairy digesters, and we learned about opportunities in agriculture through no-till practices large-scale agricultural practices like wheat growing. We discussed as a corollary to the offset discussion what the right percentage is of allowing offsets to be part of the compliance picture. Until last year in the Western Climate Initiative in California, entities had been allowed to use offsets to comply up to about 8% of their total compliance requirement. There's a healthy discussion going out there with affected communities about whether that's appropriate, because one impact of offsets is that in the areas where polluting entities are located, those impacts continue to some extent to affect those communities that live in and around those facilities. And that is a genuine concern as we enter that arena here in Oregon. To what extent do we want offsets to be part of the compliance picture? So that's an open discussion. Is 8% the correct percentage? And that's a question that I think we'll have to wrestle with as we move forward. On the adaptation side, we talked a great deal about what the impacts are on agriculture in Oregon right now, what the impacts are in forestry, and what the impacts have been in our fisheries, in particular our shellfish fisheries, and how to get to that. That was the discussion of the last work group meeting a couple of weeks ago, where we had a robust discussion about what we can do in rural communities by investing some of the revenues from our carbon pricing system back into those communities. While I did not seek consensus on every issue in the work group, what I observed through the discussion on adaptation is that there is a healthy appetite for investing some of the revenues that are available through a cap and trade system back into our natural resources lands. And the right percentage is, again, a question. But what we did discover is there is, I think, a consensus that we have a good network of both state agencies, nonprofits, and quasi-governmental agencies, such as soil and water conservation districts, through which to deploy funds already fairly efficiently, and that those can be scaled up to get at larger swaths of our landscape to improve their carbon sequestration capability. There's a healthy appetite, I think, among participants to participate in the other part of the equation that we've been talking about all along in a carbon cap and trade system, which is, besides lowering emissions, we need to start drawing down carbon out of the atmosphere actively. And that is a huge component of how we meet our state's obligations that we've already set in statute. And we participate meaningfully both globally and as leaders, showing the rest of our nation and the world how we can transform our landscapes into carbon sequestration engines rather than leave them the way they are now. I'll just close this discussion and hopefully get us back on time and our agenda by letting you know what the next steps are. We all know that the deadline for submitting legislative concepts is November 21st. All the chairs of the work groups and members of the governor's staff and Beth Petrino and Beth Riley will be meeting later this week to try to roll up everything that we've learned, get it in a form that is understandable to Maureen McGee down in LC, and refine our request for a new bill, which is likely to be a House bill. There will also be a companion Senate bill that will be, as we conceive it now, will be a mirror image, but it will be a committee bill. Once that LC request has been made and Maureen has had a chance to look at it, we will be creating a high-level summary and overview of the key policy decisions that we will be making, and how we will be amending what is now Senate Bill 1070 into the new bill. So that will be available sometime, I think, hopefully in mid-December is what we're thinking right now. And then just to remind you that the bills are due back from LC on January 8th. So shortly thereafter, we'll have a bill to chew on, and stay tuned shortly thereafter for some sort of information on what the bill looks like. Whether we're ready right away to release it, I'm not sure, because we have a lot of work to do between now and then. And I think I've covered everything. Senator, can you think of anything
no,
that I've missed?
No.
Okay. Very good. And again, I want to thank every member of both the Senate committee and the House committee that has participated in the work groups. Many of you have. I think most of you have. And if you haven't been formally sitting on one of the work groups, I think you've checked in from time to time. I know Representative Brock Smith has attended almost every work group meeting, and I very much appreciate you attending mine and adding your comments and questions. So it's been, I think, so far a transparent process, collaborative process, and to some extent a bipartisan process, with diverse opinions being voiced at each meeting. And I look forward to more. So with that, I think it's time for us to adjourn our respective, or at least me, to recess the House Committee on Energy and Environment. Direct you, those of you who would like to participate in that committee meeting, to go next door to Hearing Room E. And again, folks that are following us on OLIS, you'll need to refresh your browser to catch us over in Hearing Room E. And with that, I'm going to recess the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
Yeah.
Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources back to order.
And I will bring the House and Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee out of recess.
Okay. Welcome, Ag and Natural Resources friends. We're now moving into that part of our agenda that's really focusing on our forests, on wood, looking at it in two different ways. Starting with the latest research and the potential that advanced wood products brings to us, and then taking a look at the forest fire season that most recently was experienced here in this region. So let's begin with the advanced wood products presentation. Thomas, do you want to start us off?
Thank you, Co-Chairs Dembrough and Quim, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Manis, and I'm Dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. I just want to talk briefly about the forestry aspects of this Advanced Wood Initiative, and I'd be happy to answer questions, any questions that you have as I'm here, but I'm going to speak very briefly and let my colleagues here really talk about the Advanced Wood Initiative. I want to leave you with three thoughts today that I think are the most important from a forestry point of view about this initiative. The first one is here in Western Oregon, we're a forest people, and this is the best place in the world to grow high-value trees. If you look around the rest of the world where most of what is grown are exotic species, on ecosystems that are nowhere near what they were when they started. We grow native species on native ecosystems here. But the important thing is that we're growing high-value trees. This is not the best place in the world to grow low-value commodity wood. So it's important for us to get the highest possible value out of the products that we produce. Every tree that we cut should go to the highest possible value. And Douglas fir is one of the most valuable species on the planet. So that's a really important point, and it feeds right into this value-added initiative. The second point I want to make, we've been arguing for decades now about getting more wood. We've got to get more wood from the forest. And I'm not going to argue that point, but what I am going to say is what's really important is how many jobs we create for the wood that we do harvest. We've got to increase that. The bigger number that is, the less wood we have to harvest in order to have community development, which is really important to us. So we should be focused on the value chain, starting out producing one type of product which goes to another type of company that adds value to it and goes on. And this initiative, this Tall Wood Initiative, does exactly that. We're processing products that we already make here in Oregon, and we're adding value to those and adding employment to those. And the third point I want to make, and the last one, is that here in Oregon, we're positioned on the Pacific Rim in actually a perfect spot to produce globally competitive advanced wood products for the tall wood building industry. Whether we're talking about the west coast of the United States, or we're talking about Singapore, or Malaysia, or other developing regions that don't have a strong wood supply that we can supply to the world. So it's a bigger opportunity than Portland to think about what we can produce here in Oregon. So I'm happy to answer questions now if you have them, or we can put those off to the end. But those were the points that I wanted to make, and then I'll pass it on to my colleagues.
Thank you, Thomas. Yeah, we'll wait till the end and take questions from all of you.
I think I'll stand so that everybody can actually see me. I'm Judith Schein. I'm a professor of architecture at the University of Oregon, and I'm director of design for the Tall Wood Design Institute, which I think most of you know is a collaborative research initiative focused on advanced wood products that combines the strengths of both universities. Sustainable design, which has been kind of the brand of University of Oregon for a very long time, for 50 years. The strengths in forestry and engineering in OSU. And of course, our mission is to promote the manufacture and application of wood products in Oregon through research, testing, outreach, and education. And I want to thank all of you for your support in the legislature for the Institute, which we really appreciate. So we, I think you know a lot about mass timber already. Of course, you know that timber is a big, there's a big legacy of it in the state that we are interested in, as Thomas has said, in making new markets. Of course, it addresses climate change through carbon sequestration, and there are big performance advantages to using wood in building. So mass timber is not just cross-laminated timber. You're going to hear Tyler Ferris talk about mass plywood, but you know, there's glulam and nail and dowel laminated timber and LVL panels and lots of things that have been around for a while. So it's actually a new field, but CLT, cross-laminated timber, and mass plywood are new. And of course, we know that D.R. Johnson in Riddle, Oregon, was the first producer of certified CLT in the U.S., which is very exciting. So our institute is working to overcome a lot of barriers to its adoption in the market. Cost uncertainty is lack of knowledge among professionals. Code issues, because it's not really incorporated in the code. We're doing performance testing, and also education. So we're also, through a bunch of research funding from the federal government, through the USDA, are doing research in a lot of different areas. I'm not going to go through them all. Seismic issues, fire issues, and thermal and energy performance issues. And we're also doing product development and testing, working with D.R. Johnson and Freire's Lumber on testing of the panels and providing peer review and testing for projects like the Framework Project in Portland, the Glenwood Project, which Christine will be talking more about, and other cities that are interested in these projects. So at U of O, we're also helping with demonstration projects. Christine will be talking more about this, but we were asked by the City of Springfield to see if it was feasible to make a parking garage out of mass timber. We were not really sure. And we took 26 students and a bunch of consultants, and we did a studio and determined that, in fact, it was possible. And as I think you know, it's now a real project that SRG is designing, using a lot of the ideas that came out of our studio. We also taken on other projects. Hayward Field is rebuilding the grandstands. The initial design was in steel. We didn't think this was really appropriate. So we did a studio last spring where we looked at several different solutions for the canopy in mass timber, and we've heard that there's going to be an announcement in November, and we're hoping there's going to be good news about that in a lot of ways. We are also currently working with Lane County, who's asked us to do a studio looking at their new county courthouse as a mass timber building. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Christine.
Do
you want me to keep doing this?
Yes. we put this mm-hmm. together pretty quickly. Over the weekend is what I'm talking about, so I haven't even seen my slides yet. There we go. So Chair Dembrough and committee members, thank you so much for giving us a chance to talk. I started thinking about mass timber when I, as a mayor, and I'm sure maybe you do too, is you try to figure out what the heck we're going to do for economic development, what we're going to do to teach our kids so that they, so that we have good graduation rates, bring business mm-hmm. to the communities, how we get them into careers. And now there's an emphasis on career technical education. So, and I needed to redevelop an area between Eugene and Springfield called Glenwood, and I wanted to do something there that was would bring people in, give them a chance to see something mm-hmm. along the river, and as part of our master planning, is be something we could be proud of. And so I went right for a mass timber parking structure, and then found out that, no, we don't have codes, we don't have this, we don't have that. So the bottom line is we met with Judith, and she agreed to do a parking structure with a class. And what you're looking at there is the finished design. It's been through a shape table in San Diego. It's going through all of the final test to make sure that it can do what it's supposed to do. And part of it's going to be on the river, so now they're finishing up with some more testing. But it's planned to be done in 2020 before the 2021 games. So the idea was that we create something with mass timber. And when I go back to D.C., I met a chemist from the Forest Service that said, oh, we'll be eating wood and we'll be wearing wood. And sure enough, IKEA makes sheets and dresses are made out of wood now. And pretty soon we'll put cellulose from wood around apples so that we don't have to use wax. The idea is we're on the cutting edge in Oregon, and we have been. I get called nationally to talk about what we're doing here, right here in Oregon. And I have partnered with our school superintendent. We have brought in industry and said, if we're going to design a school curriculum, what would it look like to take our students and get them excited about timber and about what we could possibly. We're on the cutting edge. I want to stay there. I'm upset that there's a new CLT plant being built in Washington. We should have gotten that. So we are still considered on the leading edge, and I continue to be asked about what we're doing. So our partnership with the schools, with the Chamber of Commerce, and with, I would go past, let's look at Hamlin. And
it's Hamlin.
That is, but the other ones are, if, I think there's a couple more. Oh, he didn't put them in there. Okay. Anyway, as part of what we did is we put, the school superintendent is now building a brand new middle school that is state of the art. It is geared towards CTE education. And the kids are going to be able to touch CLT. They're going to be able to look how it works. And they're going to be able to start studying it in middle school, which is where we want them to start thinking outside the box about what we can do with wood products that is new and sustainable and that our kids can grow up and be part of and can assist the rural communities, because we're working with Dr. Johnson. She is our other part of our, we call it our dog and pony show that we take out. We were just at the Oregon School Boards on Saturday giving them that presentation. So I thank you very much. I'm so excited about what the possibilities are and wanted, and I'm very happy to get to share that.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Tyler, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me here. My name is Tyler Ferris. I'm Vice President of Ferris Lumber Company in Lyons, Oregon. I'd like to start out by just giving you an overview about what our company is and what we do, and then also about the exciting developments in the mass timber panel industry that we're trying to work with right now. So our company was founded in 1922 by my grandfather, T.G. Ferris, on a small mill up in the Sandium River. We moved down to our current location in Lyons about 1950, and we converted to veneer manufacturing, which was considered very avant-garde at that period of time in the late 50s. Now, however, we've grown over the years, and we operate two veneer facilities, a dryer facility, a cogenerational facility in which we produce 7.2 megawatts of electricity off of wood waste, some of which we pull down even from urban areas like Portland. That's enough electricity to power about 5,000 homes in our area. We also run a stud mill and a fleet of log and highway trucks, about 50 different trucks. And all we have about, we would like to have about 480 employees, although right now we're about 430 employees. And we will also be putting in our new MPP manufacturing facility that's ongoing right now and is intended to be operational on Christmas next month. So this is the mass plywood panel. We will essentially be creating a large veneer-based mass timber panel that's 12 feet wide, 50 feet long, and can potentially be up to 2 feet thick. I would like to say that this is a concept that hasn't been attempted anywhere in the world yet. This is an idea that has been U.S. developed and Oregon State tested, and we're looking at producing the Sandium Canyon here in Oregon. These were a display panel that we made for the Portland Art Museum under the direction of Lever Architecture up in Portland, who made the Albina Yard project, which is one of the first CLT projects up in Portland. And they've been a wonderful partner as well. So that's the maximum dimensions. As I mentioned, the main difference between what we're looking at doing and versus what a standard CLT is that CLT is lumber-based. What we're producing is veneer-based, so you can see all the individual lines of veneer that are within this panel. There's a whole lot of benefits to this, but one of the most important benefits is that we are not limited by log diameter to the type of product that we can make out of it. Our average diameter for the type of log that we use for engineered wood products is only 8 inches. It's very difficult to get very much supply of a 2x8 for a CLT product for an engineered lumber product like that. While with us, we can use any type of log in order to try and create a veneer-based mass timber panel. These panels in particular were requested by the American Wood Council and shipped down to San Antonio, Texas for advanced fire testing. These panels burned for more than 4 hours within a large-scale fire test and performed very well. This is our new facility. It's 4 acres under roof, being constructed in Lyons, Oregon. The entire process has been developed by us and is unique to the world. There is no one else that's producing a panel like this anywhere else, and we're very interested to see if we can when the facility actually starts up in Christmas. This investment marks about a $35 million investment for us as a company. This is a huge risk for us. We fully believe in the mass timber panel industry going forward, and that's why we're making this cutting-edge jump into the industry right now. These are some of the robotic gantries that are going to be in place in the facility. Those have actually already arrived at our facility and currently being installed. And that is the mass timber panel press that we're actually installing at this period of time. That's going into our facility right now. And the right picture is a picture of the CNC operations that we will be incorporating into the facility. Now, I just completed a couple sales trips around the U.S. for NAHL and other trade shows, and what is astounding to me is that the ideas about how to use this type of product are just emerging. Everyone, if you tell them that we will create any type of product within the dimensions of 12 feet wide, 50 feet long, and 2 feet thick, then people's imaginations go wild. So I think there's a whole lot of existing products that we can make ahead of time, a whole lot of currently certified products we can make ahead of time, but what we're really excited about is the potential for the mass timber panels going forward. This is actually a picture of the First Tech Credit Union up in Hillsborough, Portland, that's being put together by Swinerton. They're a contracting firm. I would say that all of these panels that are produced in this facility are actually made up in Canada by Structure Lam. This is the type of product that we would very much like to be involved in going forward, and we look at this as the future of multi-story construction in Oregon. And with that, I guess I'll stop for questions. Thank you all very much.
Okay, great. Well, let me ask the first question. This is all, of course, very exciting. And you know, we've been hearing about this for a couple of years now, and just to hear how the interest is growing and the potential seems to be growing. The question I have is, obviously, we want to see this manufacturing happening here in Oregon, and so we would like, really to encourage the kinds of things that the mayor and Tyler are working on. If we are able to have the manufacturing here in Oregon, we also want to have the lumber coming from Oregon as well, right? So what effect do you see this happening on our forest practices? What does this mean for what's going on in our forests here in Oregon?
I guess I'll take that one, Senator Denbrough. I am really encouraged by this initiative in terms of what impact it can have on forestry in Oregon and beyond in the Pacific Northwest. And the reason is that now we're selling and working with a new constituency of architects and specifiers where sustainability of wood products is the key issue that they care about. You know, for so long we've heard, well, if you put certified wood in a Home Depot next to uncertified wood, people won't pay a premium for it. But here, they do pay a premium for it, and they do really care about it. And we're going to have to reach out to those architects and those specifiers, and over time, show them how our product is more sustainable. And I think we can do that in Oregon. I think we have an enormously sustainable product and a great story to tell about the native ecosystems that we have and the way that we manage forests better than anybody else in the world. And I think that over time, that can really upgrade what we're doing. We can improve what we're doing and really focus on sustainability and green products in the future.
Thank you, Thomas. Before I turn it over, let me just ask one more question. And for you, Tyler, you mentioned that you have a goal of a certain number of employees, and you're at a somewhat lower number now. What's the difference?
Well, I mean, frankly, we're constantly hiring. And the biggest issues that we face is they can't pass a drug test and they don't show up on time. Yep. Those are the two biggest issues. You know, we will, and we do, and we have hired people back four or five times because they said, of course, they've changed their ways or trying something else. But the fact is, you know, we can't pull in those other 50 people we're looking for. When we create this facility, a lot of it will be robotic, but at the same token, it will be a very technical facility. So we will be hiring about 14 to 16 people that will all be much higher paid and much more technical than most of the other employees that we're looking at on for our current production lines.
Okay, thank you. And Mayor Lundberg, I just want to applaud what you had to say about bringing the high school kids into awareness here and the career technical ed. Potential connection here. Senator Olson, I think, first.
Yeah, thank you. Last week I had the opportunity to go to OSU and we had a forum on climate. And one of the things I came away with was that discussion on the forest was we'd like to increase the cycle of harvesting from 50 years to 100 years. How's that going to impact your ability to provide product?
Well, it's a challenge to produce the same level of products from 50 years to 100 years. What we have to be able to do to be, and I agree that's the best way to increase the carbon sequestration in our current forest. And I think that's what Dr. Bevlaw said to you in the meeting last week. And I think that maybe 100 years is pretty far out there to think about. But as we increase the value of the product, the rotation age naturally increases. If you have a very low value product, then you've got to harvest it on a 35, 40 year rotation because the interest rates eat you alive. As the value of the product goes up, you can afford to grow it longer. Douglas fir, the mean annual increment of Douglas fir matures at about 80 to 90 years. That's when the tree, the physical growth of the tree actually slows down and it's growing slower than it was before. So I think 80, 90 years is a great target for out there in the future, but it's got to be economically possible. Now at the same time, we have to do research on Douglas fir and on precision forestry and things like that to increase the growth rates and increase the wood quality of the products. We can't stop doing that and just say we're happy with what we have. If we're going to grow things for longer rotation ages and we're going to make that globally competitive, we have to change the way that we manage in the forest.
Follow up?
Yes.
This goes to the construction side of it. Seismically speaking, you know, we're really in the seismic era now that we look at. How does the CLTs and these panels hold up under seismic pressures?
I guess I'll take that. Very well. Right? We just had there's a big test on a shake table down in San Diego. It's part of a big research project funded by the NSF. And they were testing out one of the new systems that was emerging from New Zealand after the big Christchurch earthquake, where they adapted technology that had been used for reinforced precast concrete to big their laminated veneer lumber panels, but now we're using it for CLT panels here. Essentially, what they've developed is something called a rocking wall, where they post-tension the panel with steel rods, which are connected through small steel, either U-joints or split rings, rings. Those deform when there's what we call a seismic event. Everything moves sideways. The rods allow flexibility, and the U-joints or split rings will deform. If they deform enough, they break, but the panel is fine and will just snap back into place. And the big advantage over precast concrete panels is they will do that, but they crack, and you can't reuse them. So they'll protect life safety, but you can't rebuild with them. And in Christchurch, they had to tear down all the buildings and start again. If you do it with mass timber, you can actually rebuild with the same panels, which is a big advantage. And that's a system that's going to be used in the Framework Building in Portland and in PV Hall at OSU.
Follow-up? This is a construction question.
Okay.
So what's the system? How does it tie to the earth to hold it in place? Is it through steel through the through the material?
There are very big anchor bolt connections the foundation, to the concrete foundations. And then steel rods come up from the foundations through the panels themselves.
Yeah. And this is designed into the panel? You can actually preform the steel into the panel, or is it you have to pre-drill the panel, or...?
You actually, for CLT, you actually leave out some of the lams, which is what they did at PV Hall. They actually manufacture it with the right openings in it for putting the rods in. And with the mass plywood panels, I assume it's going to be drilled. But again, because all of that can be done in the factory now with the new robotic machines they have, it's all pre-cut before it gets into the field.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I have Rep. Springer, then Senator Bertschinger, and then... Rep. Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm excited and encouraged to hear about the partnerships and the projects in Lane County and a Springfield project also. That's awesome news. To Tyler, who is the largest employer in your area?
Oh, we are, by far. Yeah.
I knew the answer to that. Thank you. And I want to point that out, and there's also room for 50 more employers, which I love hearing urban parts of the state talk about products that are dependent on rural parts of the state to produce, especially when it is the largest employer, not in Lyons, but we're talking the entire Santiam Canyon area. So I'm glad you're here. That's a phenomenal product right there.
Thank you. Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, and I have two questions, one for Dr. Madison and one for Mr. Ferris. Dr. Madison, at Doug Fir Tree, I couldn't agree with you, even though it's not really a fir tree, I couldn't agree with you more that it is. It's just a wonderful tree, and other people around the globe have figured that out and started planting it there, too. But for the panel, we have a lot of discussion about old-growth timber. And, you know... what is the average age of a Doug fir tree? And I'm not talking about the oldest one. I'm talking about when the tree actually really just stops producing. And it may sit there for 100 years and produce nothing, but it just, what would that age be?
Well, it's such a complicated question because fire controls the age of our forests more than anything else. We get trees older than, say, 200 or 300 years, only in isolated spots where fire wasn't able to get to them, because the return interval on fires is quicker than that. And it also depends on everything. The site quality, how good is the soil, how deep is the soil, what's the elevation? For me as a forester, when I see a stand of Douglas fir on a good site, around 200 years old, it takes your breath away. I mean, you just, wow, that is a vibrant forest. It's probably slowed down in its growth, but if it's still healthy, it's something to see. As you get older than that, the forest starts to fall apart, really, and it might have a lot of value for certain types of ecosystems and certain types of wildlife habitat and things like that. But, you know, decline starts in above, say, 200, 250 years where the forest is actually coming apart. And it depends on the site. On a really high-quality site, you wouldn't see that as much. But we talk of, I mean, Douglas fir will live to 700, 800 years old if it can be protected from fire and it's on a good site. But these stands are not, you don't look at them like, wow, that's a real stand of timber. You know, it looks more like a mixed level and mixed forest.
Okay, and question for Mr. Ferris. Your log supply, how much is coming from private lands and how much is coming from federal lands?
Well, so we're actually the nation's largest purchaser of BLM sales, primarily because we have to. We don't have a large private land base of our own to provide a consistent amount of timber for our own mills. So we have to be out in the market consistently. So I would say on a whole, we're about 40 to 50% federal. We're about 20% state. We're about 15% privately, our own private land on an annual basis, and the rest of it is open market. And those percentages move around by about 5% every year on one area or another.
Follow up. How many loads a day are you now running through the mill, and how many loads a day could you run through your mill?
Well, so right now, as far as just today, we're running all of our facilities on a straight time basis, although the market would actually bear us running significantly harder, and that has to do with log supply, primarily just due to the fire closure this summer. We process about 70 truckloads of logs a day. That's what we need to keep our inventories even. During the summer, we usually take in about 120 truckloads of logs a day. Our single largest constraint to growing as a company is timber supply. If we had adequate timber supply and we weren't competing with low-priced imports with a very high-priced raw material, we would be employing a lot more people than we do right now.
And how many loads are you getting off of Forest Service lands?
So it's a little bit tough to tell because at least today, because we had 12 sales operating this summer when they were all shut down for the fire season, and then it was immediately followed by the heavy rains. And so the operating season is also very difficult for us on the federal sales because they don't really allow operating again until June, and they close down in September. So we've had to postpone most of the harvesting on a large bulk of the federal sales that we operate on right now. But we would like to operate on all of them. At that point, we'd probably be getting in 50 truckloads a day of federal sales right now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Rep. Escobel.
He hit on what I was talking about. I wanted to know what the mixture was.
You wanted to leave time for Rep. Brock Smith, who will be our last question.
Then I'll keep talking.
Sorry.
I didn't know we were cutting off the panel so quickly. Tyler, it's good to see you again. It was, you know, we last time I saw you, we did that mass timber tour up in Portland, and actually got to see that first deck building firsthand. It's pretty magnificent, and. And I'm glad it was pointed out earlier that those beams are coming in from Vancouver, B.C., when we have the ability, and congratulations on your tooling out of your facility to do so. It's quite an investment that your company is making, considering the lack of the federal resources that we could have if we can shift in policy. And so I'm gonna shift the conversation, and I don't want to catch you on a question that you don't feel comfortable in answering, but earlier this morning we sat down and talked about the cap and trade legislation that is moving forward in this building, and ever since the beginning of those discussions, since I've been involved, I can't separate the ability of rural Oregon to sequester greenhouse emissions, and then therefore the ability of this technology that is so inspiring to so many, of sequestering that carbon for hundreds of years, and how they're connected, in my opinion, and one of the reasons why we need a very in-depth and thorough discussion about that as we move forward having these conversations. And we heard the director of the DEQ this morning when talking about the 0.14% of greenhouse emissions that Oregon produces is minuscule to the global scale of things, and how we can be a leader in sequestering carbon, not just for Oregon, but for the nation and the world, by investing in this type of technology, by growing our forests so that we can harvest the materials and invest in this technology, and really looking at, as conditions change on the landscape, also having the policies that manage those conditions change to adapt so that you can have your supply that you need to sequester this carbon. Would you agree that those things and those philosophies are necessary shifts that need to happen in order for these industries to be successful?
Yes, I would, and I think we've seen some of that with the amount of enthusiasm that you get from architects and engineers with a new product to work with, but also with the green stories that they're able to put out there. There's one particular developer up at Carbon 12, was a construction up in Portland, and he feels like just by using the Douglas fir base panels that he's using, he far exceeds any type of LEED standard that's currently in existence. So I think we have a very good green story to tell, especially with carbon sequestration.
Thank you.
Hey, gentlemen, I think we're going to leave it at that, if you'll indulge. Is that okay? Yeah. We have this important other panel. Thank you very much, all of you,
thank
for
you.
Coming.
Thank you.
It probably won't be the last time we're going to ask you to come back. But thank you.
Always happy to come back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's have our final panel, which is going to talk about the fire season. And Senator Bercher, you're going to kick us off. So
great. Kick us off or get kicked? What?
Well, we will
we'll
hold judgment on that.
Yeah, I've got a gavel here, too. See how that goes.
How are you?
You don't have to be nice to him.
Yeah, bad cop. That's right. He's a, I don't need a courtesy vote out of him ever. I don't think he's voted for any of them.
Am I safe? Are you guys behind me?
Yeah, for behind this room. This is the way the lines are, isn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairs. For the record, Senator Herman Bercher, District 2. You know, I thought this panel might be interested in a perspective of not a senator, a perspective of not somebody who's worked in the forest industry, a perspective of somebody that has been in wildland firefighting for many years, a perspective for somebody that has been in wildfire management. Or maybe perspective of somebody that's been an instructor in wildland fire science. And that's the perspective I'm going to give you today, because I've done all of those things. 2017 was actually a milestone in my life. My first fire was 1977, so that gives me 40 years under my belt. That's a long time I'll be doing this stuff. You know, as long as we have forests, we're going to have fires. There's no question. It's a mathematical equation. When the moisture is diminished to the point where it can be ignited and stay lit, you're going to have a fire. It's no different than it was 300 years ago. And it's going to be no different 300 years from now. So where do we fall in with this? What can we do? 300 years ago, Mother Nature was the forest manager, primarily. We have some evidence that Native Americans contributed to some of those management, but pretty minor evidence, but some. Today, we got 330 million people in this country. We contribute to forest management and also some of its demise. When you look at more than 65% of the fires are man-caused. When I did a little research on that and just kind of scratched my head a little bit, I said, you know, if we take these fire seasons and we remove 65% of the fires out of the equation, we're no different than we were 300 years ago. It's fires burn, just like I said. When the moistures are diminished and you have ignition, you have a fire. The forest could be just a tinderbox. If you don't have ignition, you don't have a fire. Like I said, it's a mathematical equation. I want to dispel some of the rumors that I hear in the newspapers. I hear, oh, it's climate change, and it's this, and the forests are overstocked. And, you know, I don't know if it's climate change. I mean, you can't, you know, we got this many people on this planet. That's got to have some effect on the climate. I don't know to what point, but I don't even know if it's measurable. I have no idea yet. But I do know people have a big effect on forest and forest fires. The more people that we have living in that, what we call the urban interface, it's where the forest meets the people, we have those ignition sources. Our fire seasons are the same, it's just we have more ignition sources and more fires, especially at the low elevations. You know, if you unwind the clock back to the early days of the Forest Service, and I always like to go use the fires of 1910 as a great example. Fires of 1910 burned up 3 million acres in Idaho, Washington, and Montana. And if you look at what caused that fire season, you say, well, they had a really good winter, a great snowpack, a decent spring, and then in midsummer they had a series of 100-degree days, and afterwards they had a lightning storm, and boy, did we have a fire. Burned up 3 million acres, and I think 87 people lost their lives. You look at the fires of Wisconsin and Minnesota in the late 1800s, same thing. We had the conditions in the forests. They could be lit, and the fire driven, and it burned up thousands of acres, communities, and thousands of people lost their lives. You know, after the fires of 1910, the fledgling Forest Service, they kind of took on that policy that we're going to try to suppress all fires because when they get out of hand, they get out of hand. And they did that until the 90s. And then they kind of changed things and went to forest management. And the reason for that, the argument was, we suppressed all these fires, which was the natural way to manage the forest, a natural way to reduce the fuel loading. And partially, I agree with that. That's true. And some of our forests did. We have far too many tons per acre. And some of that could be because we have suppressed fires. No question about it. But we have a human element, too. 300 years ago, we didn't have 330 million people living in this country. Okay? That human element don't like forest fires. They didn't like it 75 years ago, and they still don't like it today. And I don't know about you folks, but this summer, my phone was on fire itself with the complaints, amount of complaints. So we have this, it's a problem. What are the solutions? You know, when I started talking about we have to do something about forest management, the first thing the newspapers reported is Senator Bertschinger wants to log. Logging's not the total answer. It can be part of it. Fire's part of it. You know, controlled burns. The problem with controlled burns in Oregon is our Environmental Protection Agency won't let us burn. We don't have enough burn days in the spring or the fall. If we're going to treat acres and treat it with low-intensity fire, we're going to have opportunities to burn. And I'm going to tell you, July and August are not those opportunities. Okay? Those opportunities lie in the spring and the fall. It's that simple. some people blame the Forest Service that they have a let-it-burn policy. I don't know if I want to go that far and say that the Forest Service has a let-it-burn policy. They may have a unformal, I don't think they have a formal one, but they may have kind of a informal one. You know, we had fires in Southern Oregon this year that started in July and were let burn, or we didn't put people on them for a variety of reasons, and you can get in long debates over those. All as I know is I can remember looking at fire models back in the 90s on those areas, those wildernesses in Southern Oregon. It was determined, these are Forest Service fire models produced by Forest Service employees that said, you know what, if we get a fire in these wildernesses before the 1st of September, we got to put them out because it isn't going to be a pretty picture. And I think the people of Brookings understand that picture. We gotta use all the tools, all the education, all the science to manage these forests. And it's gonna be a difficult task. You know, the federal government has over 15 million acres. I hear other people say, well, we gotta do this project work, or we gotta do fuel reductions work and everything. Let me tell you something. At $1,000 to $2,000 to $3,000 per acre and you got 15 million acres just on the federal side, yeah, who's gonna pick up that tab? That's gonna be interesting. And it's just not the federal governments that have some issues with overstocking. Private lands have issues too. And state lands have issues too. Okay? And it's not because we're not trying. It's just it's a big task at hand. So as we move forward in the state of Oregon, we have to move forward in a way that we pull all of these entities together. And we respect what the citizens are telling us. And we change our policies. And we recognize that, yes, we're going to have fires. Yes, we can do more for forest health. Some of that may be logging. It's really not a dirty word, okay? And it can be beneficial, despite what some people may think. But if we don't, you know, I've never seen a forest that actually benefits from a high-density fire. I've seen many forests benefit from low-intensity fires, but I have been yet to see a forest benefit from a high-intensity fire. The Chetco fire this year burned over the Biscuit fire and the Silver Creek fire. That area is going to be changed for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It will not come back the way it was originally 50 years ago, that we'd seen 50 years ago. It'll take a long, long time. And we have to recognize that people are going to continue to live in these urban interface areas. And when fire goes through there, and I think we've seen in California, I know I was in California in my younger years working on fires, and I used to always say, you know, in Oregon, sometimes you can't run fast enough. California, you can't drive fast enough. That's how fast the fires move in some of those areas. I've worked with municipalities, and I've worked with the Mid-Peninsula Open Space District out of San Jose trying to predict, and you know, they just keep setting themselves up for a disaster. It'll come. When we have these high-intensity fires, it doesn't do wildlife any good, doesn't do the forest any good, doesn't do people any good. So when I look at the fires in Oregon, I'm going to be very open that we need to suppress fires during fire season, and we need to put more money and more resources into forest management, especially with controlled burns. And we're going to have to figure out a way to talk to our public to let us have those days in the fall and in the spring. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Actually, it would be great if we could just move
sure.
on, Senator. Thank you very much for those comments. And colleagues, let me say, at least for those of you on the Senate side, we are going to, sometime in the near future, have a hearing on the subject of forest practices. And this, what we're about to hear from the agencies, is kind of a very important part of that. We want to hear how this last forest season was conducted, the fire season was conducted, what decisions were made. And, you know, if you could, in your presentation, touch on some of the things that Senator Bertschinger raised, that would be useful for us. But we'll be coming back to really dig into this issue. Senator, thank you for framing it up that way. You can come back up here and join us, and we'll let Mr. Pena come up.
Chairs Dembrough and Clem and members of the committees, I am Peter Dorey, and I serve as the Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm here with Ron Graham, Deputy Chief of Fire Protection, and Jim Pena, the Regional Forester. And we will be providing an update on the fire season. And I'll talk about Oregon's policy. Simply said, Oregon's policy directs the Department of Forestry to preserve and conserve forest resources through the prevention and suppression of forest fires using a complete and coordinated system. Oregon's policy also states that the primary mission of that system is protecting forest resources, second only to saving lives. Operationally, this direction means that we provide aggressive, safe initial attack to stop fires at their smallest possible size, minimizing acres burned, suppression cost, and resource loss. The 2017 fire season challenged our ability to meet that mission. We had multiple large, uncontained wildfires on the landscape, creating significant losses for Oregon. Many Oregonians suffered from hazardous air quality due to smoke. We lost significant forest resources, had highway closures, and spent millions of dollars fighting wildfires. The department was pushed to our limits fighting this summer's wildfires. We were in an all-hand-deck mode for most of the season. The eclipse and other extreme wind events tested a stretch system further. We did not actually slow down until fire season closed in October. Our complete and coordinated system proved its worth again this fire season. In particular, our partnership with landowners, operators, and contractors, and the severity resources provided by the legislature were critical to success. We could not have done it without the help of our partners, including the state fire marshals, National Guard, state police, our federal partners, including the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, local county and city leaders and emergency responders, and many other state and international partners. That said, this fire season reinforced what we already knew from the 2016 Secretary of State audit and the fire program review. We do not have a sustainable fire organization for these kinds of seasons. The 2017 fire season marked the fifth out of the last 6 years of extreme fire severity, complexity, and long duration. This summer, we've once again had to delay or spend work in our other divisions as we focused on fires. We were stretched to find resources for our fires and keep our incident management teams staffed. Frankly, we're an organization built for the average fire season a decade ago. We need to change that if we're going to continue to protect Oregonians, communities, and forests from wildfire. We also need to significantly increase the pace and scale of treatments to make Oregon's forests more resilient to fires and examine policies that are slowing the work down. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ron.
Good morning, co-chairs, committee members. Thank you. I'm Ron Graham. I serve as your Deputy Chief of Fire Protection for the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm pleased to provide you with this update to the fire season. And as Peter mentioned, we just recently ended our official fire season, although we continue to see fires as recent as last week. The 2017 fire season started off and was predicted to be an average fire season due to the wonderful snowpack that we had and adequate early rainfall. However, that changed quickly, as we discussed and heard a little bit already. The summer high temperatures and the rain stopping, some areas not seeing rain for 60 to 70 days, quickly changed that average fire season prediction and turned it into, by all measures, an above average fire season. And all measures are acres burned, costs, and number of fires. All were above average this season. There were some pretty severe impacts, and we heard about smoke impacts already, and just wanted to give you a little bit of a graphic there to see the smoke impacts on September 4th, soon after the Eagle Creek fire started. And you can see much of the state is under severe smoke impacts, not only from fires burning within the state, but fires in British Columbia and all the surrounding states. It seemed like no matter what the day was, there was wind coming from any given direction where there were fires, and the smoke impacts were very severe to the public. The public was not the only one that suffered the smoke impacts. The agencies fighting the fires also suffered from those smoke impacts. Many of our aviation aircraft resources were unable to fly or effectively perform due to the smoke. Sometimes they were landed and grounded at airports, unable to even get off the ground. While there is a positive impact to smoke on fires, oftentimes heavy smoke will keep fires down and reduce the fire activity. However, when that smoke does lift and clear out, the fire activity picks up and intensifies. So it's a very minimal benefit. But it also impacts our ability to see what's going on the ground and make good strategic and tactical decisions. So as I started out by saying, you know, it's an above average year statistically, and you can see by the number of fires that we've had, we're about over 100 fires above our 10-year average. Currently, we're tracking about 1,069 fires. And again, the 10-year average is 938 fires. Human-caused fires continue to be a concern to us. And human-caused fires were on the rise again this year and contributed to about 72% of our fire starts. In a typical year, the lightning-caused fires that we have actually contribute to more acres burned, usually about 80% of the acres burned in a given year. However, this year, that wasn't the case. Even with the great number of lightning fires that we had, lightning starts were up significantly. By mid-June, we saw more lightning this year than we saw most of last season at all. But this year, lightning-caused fires weren't the huge driver. It was about equal in number of acres burned as far as lightning-caused fires and human-caused fires. They were closer this year. So when you look at our ODF protected acres burned for this year, as we stand right now, we've burned over 45,000 acres on our protected lands. That's up about 12,000 acres above the 10-year average. So again, a significant departure, 100 fires over our 10-year average, 12,000 acres over our 10-year average. And there was really four big fires on ODF protection that drove that acreage this year. And I will speak to these fires in a little bit. The Chetco Bar fire, that was a lightning-caused fire. The Horse Prairie, which was a human-caused fire. The Horse Prairie fire was the one fire that was entirely ODF protection, and it attributed to 16,000 acres burned, and it was over around half of our cost for suppression this year. And then the Eagle Creek and Millie fires. Eagle Creek, as we know, was human-caused, and Millie was lightning-caused. Those four fires alone were the big drivers in the number of acres burned this year. All of our other fires combined on ODF protection only amounted to 5,237 acres. So those four fires were what drove our activity, in addition to helping our partners, which I will speak to in a little bit as well. As you know, in Oregon, the fire funding framework is really broken down into three areas: our base fire funding, or that which funds our fire department, our initial attack, if you would; the severity program through the special purpose appropriation, which funds our aviation resources that we strategically place across the state and use to rapidly assist ground firefighting resources; and then the large fire funding, which is a combination of general fund and Oregon Forest Land Protection funds, including an insurance policy with Lloyd's of London. There were some really good success stories this year when we look at this fire season. We heard about the impacts and the acres burned and things being above average. However, some of the success stories were the use of prevention and education outreach teams during the solar eclipse, before, during, and after. And actually, that interagency effort provided so much education and outreach to folks. We saw a decrease in human-caused fires during the week surrounding the eclipse. That was pretty significant. We were geared up for an increase in human-caused fires. That sustained effort in prevention was a huge factor in that. But just like we're not a sustainable organization for fire suppression, as I talked to the interagency partners involved in that, most would agree they cannot sustain prevention and education outreach measures like that as well. It took a huge effort. So where are we at with costs for this fire season? This is the third piece that's above average for this fire season. As we are to date, ODF's gross large fire costs are at almost $39 million. Our 10-year average is about $34 million, so again, above average. Four of the large fires that we had qualified for FEMA Fire Management Assistance Grants funding. That, and along with billings to our federal partners for fires that we suppressed on their lands, will reduce our net cost to about $33 million. And as I said, you can see the funding framework split in the previous slide that shows the $20 million shared large fire costs. When you do the quick math at 32.9, almost $33 million, we've exceeded that, obviously, by $12.9 million. Our special purpose appropriation, as I mentioned, the success of the eclipse effort in prevention, our severity program, again, was very successful. We continue to use that program and grow that program. This year, it was challenged. We had just enough, barely enough resources at times. We brought in many resources ahead of time during the eclipse. As I said, we were planning for an increase in human-caused fires. So we brought in resources from surrounding states and our Canadian partners. Had we not utilized and mobilized those resources when we did, I think we would have seen even larger numbers of acres burned in fire costs this year. What ended up happening soon after the eclipse is kind of when those warm temperatures and that rainfall effects of being shut off really came to bear. We saw instantly a lot of fire on the landscape, and our preparedness level was at the highest level in the country at 5 for a record number of days. What that means in terms to resources is that we're competing. We're competing with all the surrounding states and fires to get those same firefighters, as well as we are competing with two hurricanes. So the severity program was stretched to its limits, but again, it is very, very important, and it really helps in keeping those fires at 10 acres or less. This year, we were at a 95% success rate for keeping fires at 10 acres or less. This just gives you a little bit of a picture of the fires on the landscape this year, and this is focusing on primarily ODF-protected lands or fires that we were involved in. And you can see the map is very busy. What it doesn't show you very clearly, but if you look at it closely enough, are all the other little fires, the fires that you don't ever hear the name of, those fires that were stopped successfully on initial attack, kept to 10 acres or less, managed by local Type 3 incident management teams, and successfully kept from needing an incident management team in a large, costly, extended attack. As I mentioned, the four driving fires on ODF protection were a major factor in the fire season, but also the fires that were around us, and I'm sure we'll hear more about this as we continue. We were involved in several fires on the Willamette and Deschutes National Forest, the Whitewater Fire. As I mentioned, the Millie Fire was an interagency fire. The Horse Creek Complex, the Jones Fire, and the Rebel, to name a few. These all posed significant threats to ODF protection and thus required significant contributions of ODF resources to manage those interests and protect us from those threats. Similarly, in southern Oregon, we saw much of the same. The Umpqua North Complex, the High Cascades Complex, and the Miller Complex once again stretched our resources to the point of that all hands on deck, and that fire was our primary focus, not able to continue and complete some of the agency's other work. Transition now just a bit to those four main fires that I mentioned earlier. The Chetco Bar.
We're going to have to ask you to go quickly.
Sure, we'll wrap it up. Yeah. Yep, the Chetco Bar, the Horse Prairie, and the Millie and the Eagle Creek, again, driving fires that were the majority of the cost for this year on ODF protected lands, as well as the majority of acres burned. As the state forester mentioned, we couldn't have done it without our partners, the military department, the state fire marshal's office, state parks, and others. Came to the need when the time was the highest and performed in a very, very valuable way. We also utilized a lot of new technology. I mentioned the smoke impacts. Without technology such as forward-looking infrared cameras and unmanned aircraft systems, we would not have been able to get significant intelligence on some of the fires due to smoke impacts, and they proved to be a great resource for us. I will end with this slide and just show quickly that over time since 2002, ODF protected acres burns remains somewhat constant, while you can see clearly that all the other acres, all other non-ODF protected lands, continue to see a rise in acres burned each year, and we expect to continue to see that. Our complete and coordinated system is what makes it all work, and as our state forester mentioned, all the partners in that are what make it work, but we continue to stretch it year after year due to the complexity and severity of the fire seasons. With that, I'll turn it over to U.S. Forest Service Regional Forester Jim Pena.
Thank you, Ron. Good morning, Chairman Dembrow and Clem, and Vice Chair Olson and McLean, and members of the committees. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm looking forward to sharing, trying to add to some of the information because on the fire season, because as Ron shared, it was an integrated effort in fire suppression this year in the region, like it has been in years past. And so I'll try and focus more on the federal piece specifically, and then we'll go from there. It's a high priority for me to be here to discuss the importance of our partnership with the state of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to convey how critical it is that we work together, continue to work together to build resilient forests and communities, and to commit to continuing these joint investments into the future. In addition to reviewing this year's fire season, I'll also provide context around Forest Service investments and activities in the state of Oregon and illustrate how we're leveraging Oregon's strategic investments in federal forest restoration to increase pace, scale, and quality of active forest management on the national forest system. In my position, I am responsible for overseeing 16 million acres of national forests in Oregon, about 24 million acres in between Oregon and Washington. I also have the responsibility for our state and private forestry programs, which have delivered over $11.5 million in grant funding to Oregon over the 2015-2017 biennium. These investments support state activities of forest health, urban and community forestry, forest stewardship, seed and seedling availability for private forest landowners, and volunteer and state fire assistance. As Ron mentioned, and as everybody knows, the Pacific Northwest region had a long and arduous fire season in 2017. Across our region, which covers Oregon and Washington, we had 3,275 fires burn just over 1.12 million acres, almost 1.2 million acres of forest and grasslands across all ownerships. Of those, a total of 1,961 fires were in Oregon and burned approximately 710,000 acres across all ownerships. We spent 40 days at the highest preparedness level, meaning all available resources were committed. During peak activity, more than 10,000 firefighters and support personnel were working on fires in the Pacific Northwest region. Human-caused fires comprised nearly 62% of the fires in the Pacific Northwest across all ownerships. For us in this state, we burned approximately 750,000 acres on National Forest System lands, which is higher than what we typically experience. An inordinate amount of fires this year burned west of the Cascades, after a very wet winter, as Ron alluded to. We had a fire season that was predominantly fixed in the west, on the west side of the region, and at higher elevation with the early season or mid-season lightning storms that came through. We experienced a lot of fire starts in difficult-to-access terrain, wilderness areas, roadless areas, that became the problem fires for us as the season progressed. Overall, we had within the region about a 96% initial attack success rate across all ownerships, which is about our average year in, year out. Long durations across the region included the Diamond Creek Fire in the northern part of the Okanagan-Wenatchee that spread north into Canada, and then the Miller Complex on the Rogue River Siskiyou that spread south into California. Here in Oregon, we had long-duration fires on the Umpqua, Willamette, and Mount Hood National Forests as well. Unusual fire activity we encountered in Oregon this year included on the Eagle Creek Fire in the Columbia Basin or Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. This fire spread 13 miles in 16 hours, much of that during the night, and jumped Interstate 84 as well as the Columbia River to spark the Archer Mountain Fire in Washington. That's not our typical fire behavior. The Checo Bar Fire made a 6-mile run in one burn period and was igniting spot fires 1.5 to 4 miles in advance of the fire. And the Checo Bar Fire was the largest fire in Oregon this season. For fiscal year 17 fire season, nationally, the cumulative wildland fire costs, wildland suppression efforts, again exceeded funding available. We spent approximately $2.4 billion, and with over 28,000 people supporting fires during peak western fire season. The other unique thing about this fire season is it started this time last year. We had overhead teams in the east dealing with the fires in the Appalachia Mountains in early October into November. And so we had basically a 12-month fire season, because after those fires in the east swung down to the southwest, and then it started in the typical fire season in the northwest, Rocky Mountains, and then Northern California. So our firefighters basically, from all agencies, have had very little break from a very intense fire season. As the season-ending events started to happen in October, we shifted gears and began to operate our burned area emergency response teams, completing assessments on over 700,000 acres region-wide, including over 500,000 acres in Oregon. We found from these assessments that approximately 9.5% of the fire that burned had a high soil burn severity, 26% burned at a moderate severity, and 64% saw low or very low severity burns. We also identified over $4.5 million worth of immediate post-fire response needs to mitigate risks to life, safety, and infrastructure. This impact obviously impacted communities, both in Oregon, Washington, and our surrounding area. It did have some benefits. That low severity burns, as Senator Barslager mentioned, had some benefits to mitigating high fuels and having a positive effect on the landscape. But the question is at what cost? Primarily what cost to fire suppression, as well as what cost to human health. The land management mission of the agency is critically important to the American people. We're taking necessary steps to ensure that we deliver our mission, including key land management activities to help reduce the fire risk. Right now, we're on a trajectory with our 10-year rolling average for fire suppression that is not sustainable, just like in the state of Oregon, and compromises our all agency missions.
Jim, I'm going to have to ask you.
Yeah, with that, I want to cut it off, and then I'll take questions that will probably cover the rest of my presentation.
Right. Let me ask the first question. That is, how we did this season in terms of injury. Our firefighters, how did they come out this year?
Well, I'll speak for the fires that we are responsible for. Within our region, we had no fatalities from firefighters. We had a lower level of serious injuries, and primarily those injuries were related to fatigue, traffic accidents, or things like that. Nationally, we lost 3 firefighters in fatality incidents, 2 in Montana and 1 in California. And so for us, it was a better year, thankfully, than we've seen in other years.
Okay. Rip Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Peter, you mentioned that there's been, in essence, a flip-flop in the cause of major stand replacement fires this year, from predominantly natural cause to predominantly human cause. It's difficult. Maybe this year was an outlier. Maybe it wasn't. But as policymakers, are there any suggestions of what we should be considering in terms of possibly changing human nature, human proclivities to reduce the number of ignitions that are human caused?
I think I'm going to sound like a typical bureaucrat. Resources is what supports prevention messaging. We did spend the extra resources across all agencies for the eclipse, since we know it works. Again, though, the flip-flop was only on ODF-protected lands, not across all fires. So okay. I'd want to think more about before I recommended more investment in prevention relative to mitigation for high fuel risk.
Thank you.
So, Rep. Springer, I'm sorry. I'm going to exercise a little House jurisdiction here. And since Rep. Brocksmith's district burned up more than anybody else's in my committee, I'm going to let him ask the next question or two, then come back to you.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Clem and Chair Dimbrough, thank you for having this hearing as requested. I really appreciate it so that we can have these discussions. Yes, out of the 750,000 acres that burned in Oregon, I believe, if anybody does the math, that's quite a bit of it was the Chetco Bar Fire at 191,000 acres. I just wanted to point out that ODF protected lands, when it comes to the Horse Prairie Fire, consumed a lot of your resources, as you had mentioned. That fire would have been detected by the incredible network that they have down there on those lands if it weren't for the smoke from the Chetco Bar Fire that did not allow it to be detected and kept under the 95% of the normal acres that are burned. When Senator Bearsugar was talking about the high intensity, as you know, Senator, because you've been over that fire scar area from the biscuit and from the silver, there is such a high-intensity fire from those previous fires that there still is nothing growing in those areas because of that landscape. And the scariest thing with regards to we talked about the urban-wildland interface earlier and the fact that the Chetco Bar Fire moved at 6 miles at a time, as mentioned by the regional forester earlier. That fire is less than 5 miles from the city of Brookings as we speak. And yet there is 13,000 acres of matrix land there that is within the fire scar, but only 1,500 acres even being considered to be salvaged, and thus leaving this very snags that and fuel loads that started this fire in the first place, yet those snags and fuel loads are now 5 miles from the city of Brookings rather than the, I believe, 13 or 14 miles that they previously were. With regards to the correlation, Senator Dimbrough, and the cap and trade argument and discussions, you know, when we have these fires, we know that 25 to 35% of the carbon is released through the fire, but then the other 75 to 65% is released over the 40 years that, even if we were to get that 191,000 acres, excuse me, 1,500 acres of the 191,000 acres burned, that 190,000 acres will sit there and release its carbon over the next 35 to 40 years as it rots on the forest floor. And so as we move forward with the economics of all of this, knowing that it's going to be $33 million to the state, and knowing that 95% of the state, 95% of the fires that are on ODF protected lands are less than 10 acres, and yet we have this partnership with the federal government in, as it was stated earlier, mitigating high values from the regional forester, which goes to, I believe, Senator Bearsugar's argument of managing fire rather than fighting fire. My question, Mr. Pena, is what can the state of Oregon do to assist the federal government and the U.S. Forest Service, more importantly, in making sure that the 95 percentile that occurs on ODF-protected lands is a target for the U.S. Forest Service lands within the state of Oregon, because the state of Oregon can no longer afford the economic partnership that we have in managing fire on federal land, not just with the $33 million price tag.
Representative, do the question and then save the speech, and I want to hear his answer.
Sorry. Not just with the $33 million price tag, but the economic development loss throughout because of the smoke. What can we do to assist USFS in making sure that? And then what can we do to assist the salvage from above 1,500 acres when we have 13,000 in matrix that is already scheduled to be harvested?
I don't know where you get the numbers, because we haven't finished our plans for salvage yet on the Chetco Bar. As soon as we will, I'd be happy to share them with you.
Well, I will say...
Let me answer.
Sorry.
And so, for me, the bulk of the acres that burned this year were on national forests. The bulk of the effort that we put into resources was to keep it off of state protection lands. I think we burned, that resulted in additional acres burning on the national forest that otherwise might not have burned had we been able to focus on suppression just on the national forest to protect those values off national forest. I can think of specifically the effort that went into when it did come out of the wilderness area around the private timberlands on the Chetco Bar fire, the focus on the Blanket Fire, the focus on the Millie Fire, focus on the Whitewater Fire. We had a very specific plan with our interagency partners to keep that fire off private land to the extent that we could and minimize the acres on state protection and other jurisdiction protections other than federal lands. And so for me, get it not to start on the national forest. That's a trite answer, but Senator Bartschlager was very accurate in indicating that we are going to have fires every year. The fires that we have year in, year out are highly variable depending on where they start, the resources available when they start, and you know, how successful those resources are. We initial attacked every fire in this region. Every one of those large fires that we dealt with had an initial attack that failed. At a 96% of the fires we had, it didn't fail. We were successful in stopping a fire from expanding and damaging large acreages. And so from my standpoint, I think continuing the partnership we have with ODF and our other partners in the state, building on that, working for with state federal legislators to change the fire funding mix on federal lands. We're basically losing capability to prevent and treat around communities, treating fuels, by having to shift more and more of our budget to suppression. $2.4 million is about a $400 million increase over last year and the year before last. That's not sustainable. Just as the increases in the budget for suppression by ODF is not sustainable. And so for us, coming up with a way to work with local communities to better live with fire, the point that Senator Barksleger made about, you know, we've always had fire on these landscapes, which is true. What we haven't always had is people living in those landscapes at the degree we do now. That changes our options on what we can do with fire, but it doesn't change what fire is going to do. Unless we are able to change some weather patterns or change some starts, and I think that goes to Representative Witt's point about prevention. You know, 62% of the fires that we had were by human caused. This fire season, though, on the national forests, those large fires weren't man caused. Predominantly, they were lightning fires in inaccessible areas that we weren't able to successfully initial attack. I don't think that because of the buildup of fuels, we're going to see that change because of the pattern of ownership, where those lightning strikes typically occur in the higher elevation, in areas that are wilderness or roadless that make access difficult. And because of that buildup of fuels, the fire behavior we're seeing is significantly more volatile than the experience that Senator Barksleger experienced in the 70s, that I experienced in the 80s and 90s. In this state, we had large fires predominantly in eastern Oregon in the 80s and 90s. Now we're going to see them probably continue in the southwest, or southwest Oregon, and moving up the middle of the Cascades to kind of meet in the middle, I'm afraid, because of the weather patterns that we're seeing, the fuel conditions that we're seeing, and the urgency to protect that wildland-urban interface.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question that I probably need to tag on that would be very...
And I just wanted to follow up, Mr. Chair.
I think we have to bring this to an end.
The 15...
That's the way all your committees are. You just always bring it to the...
Senator, Representative... I heard in the beginning the senator say, and I'm going to commit right now, our whole next committee, all of it, will be on this topic in January. We'll spend as many hours at this as we have to. This ended up getting me excited about cross-laminated timber. I wasn't watching the clock, and we ended up short on our questioning. But we will spend our entire next committee on forestry and forest health and fuel loads, because for my committee at least, we don't want to sit and second-guess firefighting. We want to have the forest in the best, most healthy conditions possible. And whatever political cover we need to give to the federal legislators to make sure that the statutory federal framework allows for the best forest health on your lands, then we don't have to fight about the fires. And that's the most important thing. And we're going to spend a long time, like the entire year next year, talking about forest health.
I just want to add, thank you.
We've got people who need to go to meetings, Representative. I'd cut off Vice Chair Springer, and she didn't get to talk.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming. Thank you, all colleagues. With that, the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee is adjourned. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. And the House Interim Ag and Natural Resources Committee is adjourned. Ag and Natural Resources Committee is adjourned. House Interim.